I said what you asked me to do.
I'm not going anywhere until you tell me your son is safe.
Who's your son? I don't know what you're talking about.
I will kill you if you hurt my son.
Who is safe?
Stop me.
Are you the woman who called me on the phone? Did you call me on the phone?
No. The woman.
She called you too.
Drive.
Get out now! Get out of the vehicle! Stop! Go!
Who are you? Why are people shooting at us?
Drive the car!
Accelerate. Turn right. 200 feet. You have pursuit. Maintain a speed of 50 miles an hour. Stay in the second lane from the right.
The light's red!
Accelerate now.
And that was the dulcet tones of men and women escaping from what I described as being what happens when Skynet dated Hal. And you're listening to the VFX show, and I'm joined by John Flowers. How are you, John?
Great.
And by Matt Graham. Matt, how's things?
All good.
So an action flick, Eagle Eye, is the subject of this week's VFX show. And you just heard then we're going to try something a bit different this week and have a few clips from the film interspersed in the show. Tell us what you think. But we want to kind of be a bit more relevant and very specific to stuff that's going on. So John, how did you find the film? That clip we just heard then was from the beginning of the film when they've just been activated. How did you find the film overall?
Well, I would like to, if you don't mind, quote the AV Club and say, the film aims for 2001 by way of a paranoid 70s conspiracy thriller, but ends up somewhere closer to Short Circuit crossed with Enemy of the State.
Okay. and Matt?
I reckon you could probably put a tagline of an action film like all others.
And a film like every other film you've ever seen.
Yeah, it was great how it paid tribute to, you know, everything from Matrix 2001 and Enemy of the State all the way through to South Park episode 104 where John Stamos's brother needs to sing a high F to blow up a bomb.
Okay, good popular culture reference as always from you, Matt. So So let's swing our attention from the... Well, okay, we're going to have a couple more minutes, I think, on the plot, though, before we go to the visual effects, because obviously there were a couple of, how could I put it, holes so large that they are the things that we were expecting to come out of particle accelerators when they started. There were such big black holes sucking the story behind them. So can we acknowledge, I guess, between the three of us, John, that it was actually not what you'd call the tightest of logical scripts?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. There are definitely places where, actually, you know what's really funny? There are places not just where the plot is flawed, but there are places where a cell phone gets dropped and lost, and then later it exists in someone's pocket.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just plot problem. You know what I mean? It's just you have to throw reality out the window for this film.
And not only that, but there are a couple of, I mean, I don't know how many of you have actually ever played with liquid nitrogen, but it's awfully cold. And if you go swimming in it, it will, in fact, sting a bit and certainly not allow you to jump in and jump out and just...
Oh, was that liquid nitrogen? I just thought it was a tank of water.
I thought it was just leftover props from Minority Report.
Well, but have you ever noticed that if you want to have a really sinister computer, you have to have an incredibly elaborate design for the actual packaging of it?
Wally's not going to turn around and be sinister, is he?
Well, no, but still, there was actually some logic to the computer room, and we'll come up to that in a second, the room that had the 30,000 hemispheres of glowing something or other, but I still found that an enormous leap of faith. But I'm going to actually discuss that from an art direction point of view when we get to it, because I'd be interested. Well, I've started that discussion now. Let's continue it. How valid do you think it is, Matt, in today's audience to try and sell the fact, because this is aimed at a younger demographic, that you need to have an incredibly elaborate 30,000 hemisphere kind of room to have a big computer? I mean, surely the audience is just going to look at that and just scoff.
Well, it depends who you're after. I mean, you've got to remember a couple of years ago, Harrison Ford was, you know, trying to hack into a mainframe, you know, 10 years after, you know, the web boom. So, yeah, I don't know whether or not Hollywood's just trying to appeal to the older and the younger crowd at the same time. I'm happy if a small little, you know, mini Mac rules the world. You know, that seems the way it's going to go.
But I mean, there was some. John, can you remember or even begin to articulate why it was that they needed 30,000 shiny hemispheres for their computer?
Yeah, I cannot in the slightest begin to articulate why gold orbs were somehow miraculously able to allow the computer to be sentient and have a personality and be all-knowing. And you know, it was the strangest experience looking at that. I don't want to get into the technical or the visual effects yet, but I understand that there are two things. One is I understand that that room was entirely digital.
There was a small built room actually. That right. was like it was
like a
not...
bridge and then something else. And then the other thing is, and this doesn't relate to the visual effects at all, but my understanding is that Steven Spielberg originally came up with the concept for this film.
Yeah, he was done as executive producer on it.
Yep, executive producer.
Yeah.
One thing that, just before we get off the plot, that I would love somebody to email us and explain is how the computer needed to remove a lock that was clearly not very good at actually restricting it from putting the plot in motion. In other words, if we had a plot to blow somebody up that was being stopped, then it didn't do a very good job at stopping the computer from, in fact, you know, making explosives, putting them in horns, and getting those horns placed in near proximity to the president. I'd also like to know why that is the easiest way to kill a bunch of people. So let's swing our attention now to the visual effects, because I think we've pretty much agreed that the film is a frolicking good time of suspension of disbelief. And for the purposes of our show, we're not really that concerned about plot points as we are about whether or not we thought the effects were any good. And I do think that we do need to always, as we say, bear in mind that the visual effects work done by the team is completely at the discretion of the filmmakers and not really, you know, the plot is not under their control. If they have a sequence that requires a truck to flip, they're going to jolly well make the best flipping truck they can do. And we want to focus on that and not on whether it was valid to flip the truck in the first place. So, John, give us your take. Sony Imageworks did about 280, 300 shots for the film. How did you think it looked in terms of just visual effects?
Well, it must have been really great because, frankly, I spent the first half of the film wondering why I was reviewing the film for visual effects because I couldn't figure out where they were. And so I think that's, if anything, that's a, you know, an endorsement of how great they are. I mean, there are certainly some places, you know, we talked about the computer room and things like that. There are certainly some places where it felt a little weak, but you know, I would never have in a million years have pegged that there were, you said 280 shots.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. That's that. So much of it looked practical to me. I don't know if I'm just blind, or if I had disconnected so much from the reality of the film that I missed things, but
I think they did the usual trick of saving all their pennies for a couple of key scenes and strung it together with that, you know, intense drama. You know, there's nice little long lens shots with out of focus background and, you know, poor old upset lead actor and upset lead actress.
Well, right. What we're going to suggest you guys do, and this is a bit of a follow on from what we did with our episode at the VFX show on Battlestar Galactica. If you are interested, there are a couple of clips over at FX Guide in the main story called Eagle Eye, What If HAL Dated Skynet? And there are two actual sequences that we've got that are from the film. One is the breakout from the FBI, which we're about to talk about, and the other is the drone in the tunnel sequence. So what we're going to do in a second, and please pause your iPods if you want to do this, is we're going to play that clip and then we're going to comment over the top of it. And through a miracle of synchronization, John will be doing the same thing at his end as we're doing at this end. And we're going to start with the clip called FBI, which actually is under the section Breakout on FX Guide. And let's play that clip now. That's going to be a clip that's going to run for about, I don't know, a minute. And it's his breakout from the Maximum Security facility. Are you ready to go there, John?
Absolutely.
So for those of you that are playing along at home, we'll do that. And it starts now. So this is, he's on the phone, he's in the room, and he's going to get out. And I must admit, it's at this point that I'm sort of intrigued as to who the girl is. But I did like seeing this crane swing around behind out the window.
That did look good, yeah.
You know, and the whole idea of you've got 3 seconds and the reflection in the screen and stuff. But that is a pretty good smashing of a darn building. I mean, that's all know, obviously an effect sequence. This and him jumping out the darn window and going down to the train tracks that follow. What do you think, John?
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, I would have thought, I would have completely thought that that wasn't visual effects.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about it is that it has enough shaky cam to sell the shots, but not so much that we've got no idea or the orientation of what's going on. And also, I like the sort of thing that you'd see a lot of action directors doing is having multiple threats, like, you know, can he jump? He's got to get through the door. What does he do? And then that's a good leap. What do you think?
Yeah.
And that's a good action sequence. I think that's what we want out of film. You need it. I mean, obviously, I think he'd break his ankle if he jumped like that, but it's not so much so that I don't believe he's going to make it any way, shape, or form. What do you think, man?
It's got the nice attention to detail. I mean, the lighting and textures are bang on, and I like the animation of the crane just before he has to jump. It gives a nice little twitch of you better move or...
The shaky thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's... Yeah. Now, I know Kerner Optical worked on this film, so I don't know whether that's a Kerner Optical miniature, that shot you're actually referring to there. But as I say, Sony Imageworks did the main visual effects sequence. But I think that's completely valid. It's fun, it's original, and it's also... I like it when it's got a slight sense of humour to it that, you know, it's not all just...
Yeah, it keeps it fun.
Yeah. So any comment, John?
No, I think I was just reviewing... About 19 seconds into that clip on the FX Guide site is where the, you know, where the meat of the scene begins. Mm-hmm. And I've just been sort of looping it. It is pretty impressive. There's a nice shake. You can see the crane through the window. There's a really interesting reflection of the crane. It kind of reflects back on itself through the window. So you get this really interesting kind of halo effect.
Mm-hmm.
In the glass pane. I mean, somebody put some time into that shot.
Yeah, and there's no doubt about it. We feel like the actor is really in some peril, and he's in the action. But also, it looks believable that he's going to survive, and not, you know, it's not like one of those. There's no way you're going to get out of this alive, kind of things. But yeah, I think at this point in the film, that's a good visual effect. It's serving the plot. It's kind of funny. I like that you can see it happening behind him because that's like, you know. Because he can do these things, just surprise him out of left field. It's like, where'd that come from? I don't know how viable it is for Skynet ARIA to control the cranes of any location.
I think she's practiced. I think she's actually set aside a couple of weeks and practiced running cranes into buildings just to make sure she doesn't kill whoever she's trying to, you know, persuade.
Excellent.
Picking
excellent.
Up cars while she's, you know, in her spare time with
yeah.
cranes.
And
she's got cranes down.
She's got cranes down. And so begins the action chase sequence. And we have, of course, the what seems to be a fairly long chase sequence with the interesting, you were commenting before, the interesting sort of product placement of how many times can we name the brand of the car they're driving?
Oh, God knows how many times. I felt like I wanted to buy one at the end, though, which was, you know, I guess worked. But maybe not the one they used.
So VFX show budget extends to buying hosts Porsches. Yeah, that's a good idea.
But yeah, I mean, the disembodied voice on the phone says like five times.
There's a black Porsche Cayenne parked in the northeast corner of this block. The keys are in the ignition. Start walking.
Just touching on the voice, I mean, we hear the voice throughout the film in different environments. I would have almost liked the sound design to, you know, actually played with the different environments that we heard the voice. We heard the same voice as, you know, they would have heard it directly in their ear without, you know, any atmosphere added to it. I reckon, you know, they could play with that a little more.
Wow, that's, you know what's really funny about that? I actually, while we were watching it, mentioned that to my girlfriend.
Ah, cool.
I keyed in on that because I thought, wow, this is weird. You know, even though the phone is kind of on a chair across the room and the speaker's on, it's just this sort of mythical sounding voice.
Yeah, I went to see it in a new fandangled cinema that had, you know, 10,000 watts printed on the wall out the front and had all this disgusting green line saying Megaplex cinema.
But it looked exactly the same as the one that didn't have all the green lines on the...
And it didn't even sound any different. And
no,
you know, if they're going to spend money putting in a nice sound system, I want, you know, the sound designers to have a bit of fun with it.
Well, did you see it in IMAX? I'm curious because it came out in IMAX here in the States.
I did not. It was a blow-up to IMAX. So technically speaking, if you want to jump to that for 1 second, which we can, and I certainly do. So technically speaking, it was shot on 35mm. It was shot on a Panavision kit using Primo lenses, which are gorgeous 35 lenses, and then they did an up-resed version to IMAX. This was not like Batman, where there were sequences shot on IMAX or in 4K. This was an up-resing, and that up-resing process is similar to what they used for up-resing the non-IMAX shot sequences in Batman. But for me, it was the stuff shot 4K that really wowed me in Batman. And I didn't feel the necessity to see this film. It's a bit more of an inconvenience for me to go trundling off to go see an IMAX than it is to see a normal one. But I think it's called, there's a name for it, as the up-resing 4K process has a name, and I think it's called DMR by IMAX, but they've pretty much got it down. It's a good process. The only problem is, of course, you know, you've got the sweet spot changing, so you have to adjust the projection point. I presume you didn't see it in IMAX, John?
No, I felt the same way. I felt like there was really no reason to, yeah.
Going back to the car chase for a second, actually, it'd be interesting to see it in IMAX because there's a couple of shots in there when it was just way too cutty, Bourne Ultimatum kind of cuttiness, where the police cars are chasing the Porsche. I actually found a lot of those shots really soft and unusually soft. Not like there was a barreling effect or anything like that on the lens, but just it just felt a bit soft and out of place.
Can we actually have anything other than shaky cam in a car race now? It's like the Bourne Ultimatum is so sort of that look is so entrenched now that it's almost impossible for a filmmaker not to do a...
I challenge someone just to do a two camera car chase coverage. Go on.
Go on. I throw my gauntlet down at you, Spielberg.
Speaking of the voice, we were on the voice for a second. I noticed that the voice wasn't actually listed in the credits anywhere, and I have it on authority that it was Julianne Moore.
Oh, really?
Do you know if that's accurate or not?
I do not know, but that's a good piece of trivia to try and suss out. Mm. So let's swing our attention now to some 3D and in particular the global illumination rendering of the computer room. So the room that they go into, the room where our nemesis, our master Machiavellian HAL-esque computer is trying to control the world, is a room that is, to all intents and purposes, weird and sci-fi-y, and it does this by having, as we mentioned earlier, these 30,000 kind of semi or hemispheres stuck on a wall, what's meant to be, I think, liquid nitrogen on the floor, though my guest hosts think that it might be water. And and in this environment, one of the things that's kind of interesting is, certainly from my point of view, that just the fact that it was using the Arnold GI renderer. Now, I don't know if you know this, John, but I remember Arnold back around 2000, 2001, 2003, one of the first GI renderers, and I presume that it was taken off the market, went in-house at Sony Imageworks, and then reappeared at Monster House in about 2006. Or are these two different, do anyone know, two different GI renderers, both called Arnold? I think it's hard to believe.
My understanding is it's the same one.
Right.
I mean, I remember when Monster House came out, you know, say what you will about the film or what have you, but it was sort of breathtaking in the way that it looked and some of the, just the way that the light was scattering off buildings and people and objects and grass. And I was just, it was really impressive.
Yeah.
I don't remember when it came out. But.
I mean, it was 2006 for that film. I think the thing that's just the case now is that we can pretty much say with confidence that if you do use some kind of full-on global illumination or HDR full environment rendering solution, that notwithstanding the compute power to do it, you're going to get pretty much photoreal stuff out. And it's pretty easy to say that when you do that, it's indistinguishable, done well from you know, static sets. I mean, I certainly at no point did I feel like that digital room was looking hokey or digital.
No, I really enjoyed it, and it blended perfectly with the existing environment. I was knowing that it was all synthetic, I was just trying to focus on, contact lighting on the actors and stuff. But I found that they were kind of reverse silhouetted a lot of the time, so they weren't their faces weren't focused on the shiny yellow gold balls. if we were looking at them, we had those in the background out of focus. So one way around of, you know, getting that contact lighting, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the room was built to a limited height, and I joked before, but the idea was that they were hydrogen bubbles capable of doing sort of some kind of subatomic neural transfer net to the central computer and its way of therefore monitoring everything that was going on in the world. You know, personally, I find it hard to see that, you know, you can get anything like that to work even just for recording a sort of movie on your TiVo, let alone, like, you know, getting it to control everything in the world without a bug. But let's say for a second that you could, then I definitely think the team at Sony did a really good job in, you know, in producing a totally believable and realistic environment. I guess to a certain extent, you want a tangible evil nemesis. I would have liked to have seen, though, you know, somebody do it in a clever way, like do it in a way where they shot what was otherwise a black box in just an interesting fashion, or more to the point that, you know, there was no one thing that you could look at and say that is the evil. Like putting an eye there, putting a central focus works dramatically because everyone can direct their attention towards the eye that's swinging around on the robot arm, and the robot arm can actually hit people over the head as it did when it wants to knock people out. But in reality, it would have been nice to sort of have a distributed intelligence that you couldn't, you know, find it. It wasn't a single entity. Like, and I guess that's what I was kind of missing in the film, that kind of level of thought, you know. Sorry, John?
Well, that would have required some kind of plot progression for them to be able to actually, you know, do something rather than just run around and, you know, be in some environment that blew up.
But didn't you see the ending?
Which clearly didn't happen in this film. The sort of eye, obviously, it, when you see it, you're like, okay, it's Hal. I mean, the color, come on. But the other thing I was totally reminded of was the autopilot from WALL-E, which I don't know if you guys mentioned earlier, It totally looks like, it's like, oh yeah, we need one of those.
And also
let's make it scarier.
The spaceship from Flight of the Navigator all those years ago.
Totally. Yeah. Derivative is a word that comes to mind. Okay, well, let's...
It's got to be hard coming up with something new. I mean, you either spend time to come up with something new or you get a film made and fulfill your schedule.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
and I could not help but think too, I have to just say this, that when I mean, Rosario Dawson, all I could think about when she was in that room with all the stuff behind her, all I could think about was Gemini Division. You know, that the web, like the made for the web visual effects thing, mm-hmm. where she's literally on a green screen for the entire show. Like every minute of every episode is all green screen. And so everything behind her is kind of funky and out of focus.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say about this, though, is, I mean, especially in the scene that you have up, the still mic on FX Guide, it's just staggering how good it looks. The background is really impressive.
Yeah.
And the reflection in the pane of glass of the hydrogen bubbles.
Yeah, I must say the other slight disappointment that we have with the net full stop is that we can't put up the... Like, we tend to get those images from the studio, which is very kind of them, at, you know, sometimes 3K resolution. And I would love to put up the, 16-bit TIFFs. And we have done it in the past, but we got digged and it took our server down. So the images, if you click on them, you'll get like about a 1,200 pixel across image. But the actual original high reses, which we often poke around at here in the office, are gorgeous. But let's move on to our second clip that we want to do a blow-by-blow on, because I think it's a more realistic and, to a certain extent, more valid classic action sequence. It's the sequence that you can download the QuickTime of under explosion at the end of the tunnel, and it's where the drone follows their white SUV into a tunnel, and the plot point is that they're under attack from this computer-controlled drone, and the drone has decided that there's enough clearance in the tunnel for it to fly in and attack, and as a consequence, as we'll see in one second, there's a huge explosion and things flipping over and stuff. And I think this is probably the biggest, most impressive visual effects sequence in the film. So for those of you that have downloaded that clip, we're going to play that now. If you're ready to go, John?
I am ready to go.
Okay, and go. So they're obviously outside. There's been a bunch of action to get us to this point. And our HAL-esque computer, there she is. Oh, no, sorry, that's the drone's eye. And there's some nice on-screen graphics. And I must say, that effectively communicated the plot point in a graphic. We didn't need to hear anyone say, it can fly in. And now we've got this sequence, which actually was a lot shorter, the tunnel they had to work with. Like maybe about 60 yards long, and they turned it into about 600 yards. some nice particle smoke there. So let's just play that through and then we can go back and discuss it blow by blow. But there's the big action sequence, truck flipping. And we'll see another sequence, though we don't have it here, where they'll attack back at the drone when it circles back around, and one of our heroes will die in taking the drone down. So let's walk back through that shot in excruciating detail. No, so as I was saying, as we were talking through it, but I think you guys would agree, whoever's doing the presumably After Effects screen graphics to indicate what's going on. I mean, it's effectively communicating plot points and doing a exposition without having to say anything, right?
Yeah, and it looks pretty.
Would you agree?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of it going on, too. I was going to ask you guys earlier what you thought about just in general the way that they put together. I mean, the reason we talk about Enemy of the State with this film is a tremendous amount of this film really takes place through some odd camera view. You know, with a time code and all of this other information on it. And a lot of it's just dirty, you know, just it's been pixelated and kind of stomped on.
Yeah. Well, I certainly like it when you get something like we've got here with going into the tunnel and somebody, you know, is communicating something to us, pushes us along in terms of what's going on, tells me what's going on, and it doesn't have to have somebody scream in the car, "It's going to fly into the tunnel." You know,
that bit's kind of refreshing.
It's shooting at us. Yeah, you think?
I'm too old for this. Beep.
And that tunnel, they actually, you know, built obviously in 3D, having, I believe, 1,700 fluorescent lights placed inside it. And this is where we're really getting into some serious ray tracing, because you can't do these cars and the car finishes without getting some really good ray tracing happening. So you've got both the requirement of the environment itself and also the vehicles that are in it. Now, in terms of shots, if we go in about 16 seconds into that clip, we get the shot of the drone first appearing in the tunnel. And this is one of the few shots I had a slight problem with, which is just that it struck me that it was the wrong focus. Has anyone else got that problem?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I have three words for you. 405 the movie.
Yes.
It looks, I'm like, thank you, Bruce Brannett. It looks exactly like 405 the movie to me.
Yeah. So we're starting on a shot of the drone coming over the top of the cars. We pull out to reveal what we've been looking at is in the rearview mirror. And it just felt to me like somebody had said, look, I understand that should be shakier and blurrier because it's flying and all the cars around that are out of focus, but I want to see the drone and know what's going on here. So make it clearer.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing when later on near the end of this clip where it's coming through the smoke after the truck's flipped and exploded. It doesn't seem to really interact with the smoke so much and just kind of stands out a lot more. Yeah, probably because someone said, I'm spending my money on a drone. I want to see it as much as possible.
Oh, I'm seeing what you're saying. About 40 seconds in?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. It seems like the thing just sort of somehow miraculously, I don't know, walks through the smoke. Like it's very strange.
It's a stealth thing.
It's a stealth thing. The sound effects courtesy of Graham. Yeah, so... I mean, having said that, if I take my attention,
doesn't even pull the smoke with it.
Yeah, if I take my attention off the drone for a second and say that that is probably the weaker of the elements, I think the truck flip is a cracker. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I love the truck flip and this initial flip, and of course a later flip as the drone comes back. I thought really well done.
Yeah,
seen it before, but still really well done.
I'm wondering also, do you reckon they put a bunch of lens flares and glares and stuff in? I mean,
yeah,
they'd have got that had they shot on an anamorphic lens, but it just seemed to be nice and glary and flary, and we like glary and flary on these kind of sequences. Neons over his face of roofing things, which I don't think would actually... I mean, they look all added to me when I think about it. They didn't seem added at the time. What do you think, John?
Yeah, it looks like an afterthought. In fact, if you go up to the 37th second of this, when the two cars pass by, you can see some just wacky, wacky lighting where I don't know. It's very artificial and it doesn't feel right against the cars and the windows and everything about it is just wrong. I'm an American, so I typically wouldn't say cracker. I do think that the truck flipping is really, it's, as was mentioned earlier, it's a little bit of a, well, yeah, we've seen it before, but it was done so well. You sort of forget about that and think, wow, that's, that's a big truck going over and lots of damage happening.
Well, apparently the truck was shot outside on an airfield doing the whole flip. So, you know, the extensions of the back of the tunnel, putting the lights in and all that, I think that is great. Seamless.
Yeah, I've got to say that, and I don't know if they're still doing it this way, but Sony Imageworks used to have a division called High Speed Compositing. So they would have their compositing department, which I'm going back a couple of years, but I think it still might work the same way. And I had a lot of friends in Sony at this time. So there'd be a compositing department which would take your, here are the elements coming out of 3D, you need to be composited together and dealt with and put together in a sensible kind of fashion. Then they had high-speed compositing. And high-speed compositing was more sort of dynamic problem-solving in that, like, well, here we've got the truck footage and here we've got some flashes and here we've got some lights and things and we need to work out how to get those meshed together. And interestingly, not dissimilar system was used up at ILM, I think, where they had like a Inferno and like a Saber doing the same thing, just kind of piecing together the jigsaw puzzle as like a pre-comp. Because to get a lot of this stuff working and work out what elements will work with what is almost as big a job as putting them together. And I actually thought that, I mean, Sony's, I guess, got a pretty good reputation for 3D because of the work that they've done with like Spider-Man and a bunch of stuff like that, which is, you know, honestly, Academy Award winning kind of stuff. But I do think that they have a terrific compositing department and maybe doesn't get enough of a mention because it's sort of overshadowed by their 3D. But I wasn't looking at these car shots. And then, as you know, John, that's my favorite thing to bitch about, which is whether or not car comps were hopeless.
Right. And, pings on the cars, specular highlights. Yes.
I thought, you know, obviously a lot of it's happening at night, but, you know, must have been a lot of green screen or stuff that was shot in the cars that wasn't 100%. And they seem to be matching that really well. And I think, you know, kudos to the compositing department. We might ridicule some of the plot elements, but if I'd been a compositor on this show, I'd be holding my head pretty bloody high right now.
Absolutely. Hey, I have a question for you. Is it just me, or just in reviewing this again, and I thought it might be the case the first time, is it just me, or does this truck literally bounce into and crush three separate cars between the 38th and the 41st second? I think three cars get smashed. I mean, like, full on.
It crashes one at about 38 seconds and goes over the top of it, which leads to it bouncing up and
just canning two more.
And canning two more, yeah.
Yep, three cars.
Three cars.
It's a big truck.
Yes.
That's a big truck. That's a big bouncy rubber truck. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yes, it could have had.
We all know that Hollywood explosions are bigger and bouncier than any others.
Yes. This is not Mythbusters. We're not going to see whether a petroleum tank actually explodes. Oh. Though I did, separately to this clip, I did actually think that was a slightly, you know, too big a fireball when they took out the drone in the subsequent action sequence. Anyone remember that? When the drone comes back around again, it was.
And it dissipated really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was some Johnny Blaze Fantastic Four fireball action to me, or something out of Heroes.
I mean, I would actually say it almost looked like a propane burn, not a gasoline burn. You know, like a gasoline burns obviously going to burn darker and blacker. And it seems to me that the audience probably doesn't care about that, so it's just me being a visual effects guy. But
it's a stealth plane.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
You can't even see it's exploding.
Oh, nice. I would like to ask you another question about, speaking of fireballs and explosions and things going crazy, there's a scene where the guy gets sort of caught up into electrical wires, you know, when the electrical wires mm-hmm. fall on the guy and he just electrocuted.
I'm not quite sure how a computer can cause electrical cables to short out and break, but yes.
Right. Well, you know, it's got glowing viscous hydrogen orbs. It can do all kinds of cool stuff.
Sure.
with neutrinos. I noticed, by the way, and I actually I snuck in to the next showing to make sure I wasn't crazy and watched about 5 minutes of
audience, just so you know, John is literally exposing himself to prosecution on this podcast just to validate facts for you guys at home.
That's passion.
I am. That's how there I am for you guys. I am willing to go down just
to jail, you know. and admit it publicly. We are recording, John. I just remind you. So you had a friend that snuck in to the without
right.
paying
well,
a second,
you know,
time.
I,
yes.
I'm sorry. I paid for two showings.
Yes, okay. You
know, as you do.
And have
no,
the stuff
so
to
I,
prove.
I saw, but I only saw 14 seconds of it, which I believe gives me, you know, for the purposes of education, I'm not violating the law in America.
Anyway.
So I timed it perfectly. The guy gets electrocuted. I swear to you, he is electrocuted. He turns into a ball of electricity and then a kind of a fireball. And there is a puff of smoke that wisps away. Like the guy just becomes, he incinerates.
Yes, that's correct. That's how I recall it, yes.
It is absolutely the case that he incinerates.
Yes.
So first of all, I wanted to ask about the special effect. And then the thing I wanted to say that was weird about that is later there's a body. But
or bits of. But yeah, there seems to be a lot more remains later on, doesn't there?
Yeah, there was a wisp of smoke. The guy was incinerated. But what did you think about that? I thought the special effect for that was actually pretty impressive.
It definitely had a punch.
Okay, so if the brief was electricity wires come down and he is spontaneously combusts to only having his shoes left with smoke coming out of them, like in a cartoon, but only realistic, then it was very well done. If it was, we want to realistically see what it would look like to get electrocuted, then, you know, I mean, because honestly, I was so taken out of the film as I just nearly laughed at the, like, you know, can we just see the shot of one boot with smoke coming out of it now, please? But see, again, it's hard for me to say that because the visual effects team executed the shot well, if that's what the director wanted them to do.
Well, we did. So let's be clear. That was the direction. I mean, Come on, Mike.
And we left realism.
The direction
at the
door was Wile E. Coyote.
It was Wile E. Coyote. It was, you know, yeah. And exactly. So I guess for me, yeah, I found it very hard at this point in the film to be in the film because as the cables are coming down, I'm like, hello, this is just beyond. I mean, what are we, am I meant to believe that the computer just can somehow cause power to spike at one particular tower along a long run of towers? So I'm thinking about the physics of like how they're going to explain this. Also thinking about the physics of like, were they trying to tap into the phone calls using the power lines or their conversation using the power lines? And there was also things going through my head. And then when he got completely zapped, I just started pondering, would you actually be spontaneously combusted into nothing when that happened? So for me, now speaking as a cross between a reviewer and as a critique of the film, took me out of the film. I wasn't threatened by it. It was just it got a bit absurd. But that's why I'm not answering your question, John.
No, the question was more, I mean, if the directive from DJ Caruso or whoever was, okay, you know, this guy gets struck by two, you know.
Then they did an excellent job.
He just blows up Wile E. Coyote style into a puff of smoke.
Yeah, then it was an excellent job at doing that. Have you seen Disturbia? Disturbia?
Yeah.
Thank you. How did you actually rate the direction of this film?
Of Disturbia or of...
No, of this in light of that film.
I think he's improving as a filmmaker.
Right. I thought he was improving, but he still... And I just felt like it was... if you told me that this was his first major film... I'd have believed you. It just had a couple of hallmarks of somebody that was trying to spell it out a bit and not letting the audience... but, you know, this is my pet thing. I think the audience is incredibly intelligent and not just the listeners to this show, and I think they can go somewhere if you can take them there. And so... But anyway, I digress. So, look, we've got now to the end sequence, and there's obviously a large kind of action sequence played out as they try and... stop the president and most of the White House staff from being blown up in a diamond bomb, which is, again, slightly weird way to kill everybody, but there you go. And I think for me, I guess the question I want to ask you guys is sort of dramatically at the end, you've got the race against the clock. He's trying to get in through underneath and, you know, holds up the gun and shoots and gets obviously... taken out, but by the same token gets the president whisked out of there. Was that all working for you, and did any point actually believe he was dead?
I was hoping. Like, even before...
Dreaming.
I've got something about this kid. He seems to be in all my, you know, Transformers. Ruined it! Indiana Jones. Ruined it! I don't know. For me, I just don't like seeing him on the screen. And even before I saw the film, I had a feeling that, you know, the hero is going to win, yada, yada, yada. And then when I saw him get shot, and I thought, excellent, wow. I like to see a good guy go down for, you know, the greater good. And then when you see him later on, it's just like not so good.
I think there's a really interesting and we're going to cover this in FX PhD in a bit. But it's a really interesting piece of research. I was at a lecture the other day. I'm going to geek out for a second. To do with emotional connection and the way that the mind works in situations of storytelling. And what I sort of found interesting thinking about this film in the context of that research is they were pointing out that the way that a joke works, the way that a lot of stuff happens cinematically, is you tend to produce a query, a concern, a curiosity, an engagement with the audience. And the more you build that engagement and the more you can sustain it, the more they kind of move forward in their seats. They kind of lean forward to kind of understand and then kind of engage and open up to the footage. But there is a point at which you get it. It's like the punchline, you know, like somebody gets the joke. You don't need to hear the rest of the sentence of the joke. You kind of go, oh, you know, like I've got it now, I'm processing. You lean back and you say, yes, it's very funny. It's over kind of thing, right? And that's my problem with the structure of that end sequence is that, you know, it was pretty clear that, yes, he's going to go in and stop it. And I didn't really see there was any chance everyone's going to die. And so I kind of disconnected earlier than I think I should have because there was no real expectation that there was anyone that was going to stop him getting into that presidential area. Like once he got past the first guard that he'd fought, we figured, yeah, what, he can do anything. And so I don't think the structure of that worked for connecting me emotionally with the drama or any curiosity as to how they were going to solve the problem. Does that make sense? Like yeah. What I think you want is I don't get it. I don't see how they're going to get out of this. They've dug themselves such a hole that it's going to take a terrifically inventive piece of anything to get them out of this. Oh, cool. Wow. Didn't see that coming. Bang, bang, bang. And it all plays out. And I think that's what you crave at the end of a film. And if you don't get that, if you do understand how it's going to play out, then you kind of go, okay, I'm over that now. I get it. And then you kind of sit back and almost just wait for the minutes to tick by because you can see what's coming.
Yeah, I think also the edit of that scene didn't help because yeah. It was a cut from him, cut to her, cut to mid-shot, cut to him, cut to her, cut to mid. Okay, I've seen this bit. Come on, get to the fireworks factory.
Get to the fireworks factory, exactly. What do you think, John?
Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the editing was abhorrent at the end of it. And I'm sort of notorious for having commented once that any film that just completely falls apart in the third act should be referred to as having the Stargate effect.
Okay.
I don't know if you like the film Stargate, but I collapsed on itself in the third act. And so call that the Stargate effect. And this film suffered definitely from the Stargate effect.
Yeah, because if you were going to break this into a three-act structure, and we talk about it in terms of visual effects now, I'm wondering, could we just do something a little different and wonder how you could have played that last piece? Was there anything you could have done? Because, you know, you just want a big spectacular finish, of course. I just think it would have been nicer if there was some way that we kind of, well, either A, as they did, I think, in that, there was a film with Morgan Freeman. This is not going to narrow it down much. There was a film with Morgan Freeman as the president, but there was a nuclear attack and they actually detonated the bomb, right?
Oh, and, yeah. It's like a Sum of All Fears kind of movie.
There you go. I forget that. And so they could either gone with an actual explosion, but maybe not everybody died, or maybe they was contained in some way. Or I don't think him dying would have been enough, but I think you could have possibly built up the end and done something else that gave us a double threat. You know, because I think I even alluded to this earlier when we were talking about the escape sequence. But at the end of, say, a Mad Max film, there's a great sequence where I think, you know, you've got this sort of imminent threat. Are you going to get killed by the guy shooting him? He's going to get killed by plowing into something. Even if he gets that and gets that, he's not going to get out of this. And then all of that, even if all of that's okay, there are 50 other guys further down the rail train. You're just going to come and kill him anyway, right?
Yeah.
And so at that point, you kind of just, there is no way out. And you're really engaged just to see how they're going to solve it. And then you forget about one of those threats so that when it actually turns on itself, you weren't surprised and cheated, but you were definitely surprised and, you know, almost like, wow, that was clever. And so I guess I would have constructed that end and I would have put something in there, you know, like that.
Yeah, there was no clever savior, was there? It just played out.
It would have been better if he'd like not managed to get in there and the kid had seen his mum and hadn't, you know, I mean, there would have been a thing or something, right?
Yep.
Couldn't play the F key and, you know, because he was like too shook. I don't know, whatever. But I would have liked them to have sat around a little longer and tried to.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, they had such an opportunity here, and they just completely, you know, jumped the shark. I mean, they didn't, you know, they're pulling out hard drives, and that causes an explosion with these hydrogen bubbles, and, you know, then every way that this played out, in every step along the way, I thought to myself, you guys had an opportunity to do something so much better than this if you just spent 5 minutes thinking about it.
Now, I will say this, though, that if you could happily go along with, perhaps because you've listened to this podcast, lower expectations and just get it on DVD and be sitting around Friday night at your place with a couple of mates, then, you know, it is a good ride, you know, and there's no doubt that it's done well at the box office at the sort of level that I reckon they were pitching it at, you know. It was like a fun ride action flick. And so I think, to a certain extent, I don't want to paint this as being, you know, how my girlfriend's a superhero. It's not that level of, like, you know, kind of... because it isn't, right? Like, it's not. It's a fun, rollicking ride that you just have to forget about. This, I mean, because, you know, we kind of didn't walk out feeling like I've been ripped off. We just felt like what it was.
If the film had have ended, though, as he got shot and didn't give me the extra 5 minutes of, you know, Lord of the Rings happy ending, I would have been a lot happier.
And, oh, wow. Ironically, the Spielberg ending. So there you go. That was a Spielberg ending for sure, right? It was the, you know... The precogs are reading in a cabin in the woods. Everyone can go happy.
And look, I already got the fact that there's going to be a sequel. You know, somehow 37% had been uploaded to some remote satellite, which was going to come back for the sequel and haunt us. And I could have, you know, even...
There you go, that 37%. That would have been a good basis upon which to play out that a corrupted version of it was still loose in a completely different area and play that out.
Or a laptop flashing somewhere in a cargo hold a la... last crystal skull thingy. I've just wiped that film from my mind.
Anyway, okay, so look, in finishing up, I did appreciate the work of the visual effects team, because I thought their sequences, you know, we have not found them wanting in terms of technical excellence. I definitely think we found some plot points, and it was very hard to get around that. And, you know, it's the... To be fair, it's in the guise of, you know, being fairly critical, because if you were just interested in a movie on a Friday night with some mates and you know, happy to...
I'd walk out not crying.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't walk out being like telling people never to see it again. You know, it was a fun film, but it was a fun action flick that maybe just didn't have that dimension that, you know, because in the old days you'd have a fun action Bruce Willis flick and you'd be like, man, that just kicked ass. And this was a bit more like, that was a fun ride, but you know, what's next? Yeah. Wait, is that fair, or am I being John?
No, I think that's fair. I mean, it's, you know, it's not Die Hard.
It's not Die Hard, but...
Shia is not Bruce.
Yeah, it's not Die Hard. But then having said that, it will be, I'm sure, something that'll go well on DVD and make the filmmaker some money and hopefully keep a bunch of people employed making more movies such as that. So on that note...
Rachel Holloman, you've been activated.
This isn't funny.
Your compliance is vital.
Who are you?
Let's thank PixelCorp for providing the editing and post-production as well as the producing for our show. We appreciate your comments. And if you do want to post things, there is a link over at pixelcore.tv. That's pixelcorps.tv. And John, where can people find you to complain about your comments or throw glory at the feet of your insightful comments?
I'm hoping the truth lies somewhere in the middle, but if they want to track me down, probably lifezero.org is the best place, or I'm also lifezero on Twitter.
Excellent. And Matt, you're mainly over at FXPHD, is that right?
Yeah, floating around there.
And you can find me over at FX Guide. And again, we want to thank the team who put the show together each week and point out that next week we're thinking of doing a similar thing that we did with Battlestar and switching our attention to television again, only this time thanks to some suggestions that you guys sent us on Twitter, looking at Heroes, which has come back in the new... I think it's the third season, is it, of Heroes? Certainly like 2.5 if you don't count the first one. And so definitely a show, that I have been looking forward to, but I'll reserve my comments, although I'm still looking forward to it, until next time. Until then, thanks so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. See ya.